Okay, if everyone would please take your seats, the meeting has been called to order. We'd like to get started. The quorum is present. I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the February 7th meeting. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Cantrell moves to approve the minutes of February 7th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay, we're going to start off. So we are finally at a position in this committee where we can hear some bills. We're going to start doing that today. But before we do that, we're going to hear House File, before we get to House File 269, which Representative Cantrell's bill, we're going to hear from the Department of Health. Do we have our testifiers here from the Department of Health? Please come up to the table. And we're just going to, because Representative Cantrell's bill deals with HIV funding, I thought it would be helpful to us to begin with the Department of Health giving us a brief overview. They have just come out with their strategy report on HIV, which I know came through this committee or maybe the policy committee in the last year or so. And I know that all members of the committee have been, or those who, at least who were here before, were interested in this issue. And so I asked for a brief update before we hear the bill, just to give us some a little background and context. So, and we're waiting to try to get the, are we having trouble with the?
Yeah.
Okay. And in the meantime, Representative Cantrell, please.
Madam Chair, in keeping with tradition, I have Rob Treats for distribution to the committee. It just so happens that I have an Abdallah Chocolate Factory near the border of my district, and coincidentally, they also sell chocolates in the transportation cafeteria.
Okay, Representative Cantrell, just to be clear, members, I let Representative Cantrell know that, in fact, there is no rule in this committee about freshmen bringing treats. However, Representative Cantrell, I do want to tell you that you did kind of violate my directive, which was that we only have healthy treats in this committee, which is healthy, a health committee. But just, you know, we'll go ahead this time, but just so members know, I know Representative Zerwas was, I know that's on his mind.
Madam Chair, I think those treats are exactly what we need.
Okay, well, Representative Cantrell, there are some known health benefits to chocolate.
That's what I've heard.
So we'll just take it that way. We will not ask the department to comment on that, however. But we have our testifier from the Department of Health, and I'm afraid yes. Oh, okay. Ms. Erisman, am I saying that right?
Yep, I'm Chris Erisman.
All right, please give your name for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Erisman, and I'm the Director for Infectious Disease at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify about HIV in Minnesota and the department's work in this area. Human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, is the virus that causes acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS. I just want to make sure we have those acronyms ready to go. HIV is most commonly transmitted through anal and vaginal sex and sharing injection drug equipment, and less commonly through pregnancy, childbirth, and breastfeeding. HIV continues to be a significant health issue in Minnesota, despite innovations in treatment, prevention, and policy. Since 1982, there have been 11,598 cases of HIV/AIDS reported to the Minnesota Department of Health. For the past decade, the number of new HIV diagnoses in Minnesota has remained relatively stable at approximately 300 cases per year. At the end of 2017, a total of 8,789 people were living with HIV/AIDS in Minnesota. Of these, approximately 46% had been diagnosed with AIDS. Nearly every county in the state has people living with HIV. For the first time, the knowledge and tools exist to effectively end the HIV epidemic. Treating HIV prevents new infections from occurring and is known as treatment as prevention. Adhering to antiretroviral therapy, or ART, the medications used to treat HIV, decreases the amount of virus in the bodies of people living with HIV to undetectable levels. Scientific studies have shown that once people living with HIV have undetectable amounts of virus in their body, they have effectively no risk of sexually transmitting HIV to their partners. HIV medication can also be taken by HIV-negative people to reduce their risk of becoming infected with the virus. Pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, is a daily pill taken by people who do not have HIV. When taken as prescribed, PrEP can greatly reduce the risk of HIV infection. And post-exposure prophylaxis, or PEP, is when an HIV-negative person takes antiretroviral therapy after being potentially exposed to HIV to prevent becoming infected. PEP is meant to be used in an emergency situation and must be started within 72 hours of a possible exposure. In spite of these advancements, Minnesota is experiencing increasing health inequities and HIV-related health disparities. In Minnesota, the HIV epidemic disproportionately affects historically marginalized communities. The populations hardest hit by HIV are gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men, injection drug users, including MSM who inject drugs, populations of color and American Indians, and transgender people. These populations experience stigma, discrimination, and poorer HIV health outcomes, as well as other health disparities and health inequities. Another concern is that with the growing opioid epidemic, the potential for an HIV outbreak among people who inject drugs in Minnesota is likely. The HIV care continuum is a nationally recognized methodology that outlines the sequential steps of HIV medical care for people living with HIV. It starts with the initial diagnosis and moves to achieving the goal of viral load suppression, that is, a very low or undetectable level of HIV in the body. And this graphic will go through the steps of each of the stages. It's important to recognize that people living with HIV may not be in a position to reach viral suppression because of factors that limit treatment access. For example, inadequate access to care, poverty, racism, denial, stigma, discrimination, and criminalization. The HIV care continuum consists of four stages with the ultimate goal of viral suppression. The HIV care continuum begins with the diagnosis of HIV infection, and that is indicated in the first bar, the number of people who know their status and then the number of people who are unaware of their status. The only way to know for sure that a person is infected with HIV is to be tested. Individuals need to be aware of their infection before they will seek HIV care and treatment. The estimated number of people with undiagnosed HIV infection, which is about 1,100, underscores the importance of continued and intensified efforts to reach more people with testing. And then the next bar that we want to look at is the green, the lime green bar. Being linked to competent HIV medical care within 30 days of diagnosis and starting medication early significantly lowers the possibility of developing AIDS and other illnesses and reduces the risk of transmitting HIV to others. In Minnesota, 82% of the people diagnosed with HIV in 2016 were linked to care within 30 days. And then the next bar is about retention and care. HIV has no cure, so treatment is a lifelong process that requires a person to receive ongoing medical care. Because of the benefits of antiretroviral therapy, it's critical that people with HIV infection stay in care over time. For people living with HIV, retention in medical care is an important step to becoming virally suppressed. In Minnesota, 73% of the people living with HIV are retained in medical care. And then the last bar is about viral suppression. Having low or undetectable levels of HIV in the blood helps people living with HIV stay healthy and live longer, and effectively eliminates the risk of transmitting HIV to sex partners. Viral suppression does not mean a person is cured. HIV still remains in the body. If medication is discontinued, the person's viral load will likely return to a detectable level. That's why keeping people in care is so important. In Minnesota, 64% of the people living with HIV are considered virally suppressed. This care continuum clearly indicates that there are areas where increased attention is needed to ensure that all individuals living with HIV in Minnesota are aware of their infection and are able to realize the full benefits of available care and treatment. It also demonstrates that efforts are going to need to focus on communities with the highest rates of new HIV diagnoses and the highest percentage of out-of-care individuals in order to decrease and ultimately eliminate new HIV diagnoses in Minnesota. Well, how will we get there? The Minnesota HIV strategy provides a roadmap for coordinating efforts and resources to address HIV and lead toward the ultimate goal of eliminating HIV/AIDS in the state. The strategy is a legislatively mandated plan signed into law by Governor Dayton on May 20, 2017. The law requires that the Commissioner of Health, in coordination with the Commissioner of Human Services and in consultation with community stakeholders who form an advisory board, develop a strategic statewide comprehensive plan to end HIV/AIDS in Minnesota. The 2017 legislation coincided with work on a statewide HIV strategy already started by the Departments of Health and Human Services in August of 2016. The vision of the strategy is that by 2025, Minnesota will be a state where new HIV diagnoses are rare, and all people living with HIV and those at high risk of infection will have access to high-quality care and resources they need to live long, healthy lives free from stigma and discrimination. The strategy is the state's blueprint to end the HIV epidemic and has five goals. The first one is prevent HIV infection. The second is reduce HIV-related health disparities and promote health equity. The third is to increase retention and care for people living with HIV. The fourth is to ensure stable housing for people living with HIV and those at high risk for HIV infection. And the fifth is to achieve a more coordinated statewide response to HIV. Successful implementation of the strategy will require achievement of four measurable outcomes, which are also part of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, or NHAS. The Advisory Board of Community Stakeholders identified the year by which each of these outcomes will be achieved. The first is increase the percentage of individuals living with HIV who know their serostatus to at least 90% by 2020. And this is an objective that Minnesota has met. The second is to increase the percentage of individuals diagnosed with HIV who are retained in care to at least 90% by 2025. And as you can see, we have work to do to achieve this objective. The third is to increase the percentage of individuals diagnosed with HIV who are virally suppressed to at least 90% by 2025. Excuse me, 80% by 2025. That will be tough enough. Minnesota has work to do to achieve this objective. And then finally, the fourth is to reduce the annual number of new HIV diagnoses by at least 25% by 2025 and 75% by 2035. And we clearly have work to do to achieve this objective as well. Achievement of these objectives are steps that will help us reach the ultimate goal of eliminating HIV in Minnesota. Let me summarize by saying that HIV remains a significant health problem in Minnesota. And there are populations that are experiencing disparities related to HIV here in the state. The development of a statewide comprehensive plan to end HIV with input from the community is underway. And implementing this plan is a means to reach the goal of no new diagnoses of HIV in Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Harrisman. Representative Munson?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question on this slide. On page 4, I think it's slide 7, the HIV continuum of care. The first block that has the the number of undiagnosed listed as 1,000. I read the bullet point down there. I'm just wondering how you determine the number of undiagnosed HIV cases, and then your plan is to reduce the number of new cases by 25%. How does that conflict with trying to identify the people, but then at the same time not identify them?
Yeah.
Ms. Erisman.
Madam Chair and Representative Munson, that's a very good point. First of all, the proportion of undiagnosed is based on formulas that CDC provides to the state. So based on the number of cases that we have, then they help us identify what we would expect to be our undiagnosed cases. And then to your second question, you're absolutely right, that initially we will see an increase in cases as we're doing more testing. But ultimately, when those individuals are tested, they get into care and receive treatment, then we will see a reduction in transmission. So you're right. Initially, we will see a slight increase as we're identifying these people who have not yet been diagnosed with HIV. But ultimately, by getting them in care and having them treated, we'll see a reduction in transmission.
Follow-up.
Munson.
The CDC numbers that you had quoted as projections, that's based on national numbers, or is that just for our state? Because I feel like we're kind of a leader in HIV prevention in Minnesota.
Ms. Erisman.
Madam Chair and Representative Munson, that's based on looking at what we see nationally, but then tailoring it to Minnesota.
All right. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the prevention include condom use, as PrEP can create a false sense of security for individuals? How does that play in?
Ms. Erisman.
Madam Chair and Representative Franson, the emphasis for PrEP is that it does reduce a person's viral load to undetectable levels, but we still encourage use of condoms because there are other sexually transmitted diseases that a person can acquire that are not covered, obviously, by the PrEP medication. So while PrEP will help a person be protected against HIV, there are other sexually transmitted diseases. So condom use is still a part of safe sex.
Representative Franson.
Okay. Thank you. So if an individual is using PrEP and so to decrease their viral load, if they are having unprotected sex with somebody who has not had HIV, are you saying the transmission would be, they would not transmit at all?
Ms. Erisman.
Madam Chair and Representative Franson, yes, there have been a number of scientific studies that have looked at that. And so if an individual has undetectable viral levels for HIV, unprotected sex would be considered safe. But there are other sexually transmitted diseases, syphilis, gonorrhea, and so that's where condom use is beneficial.
Yeah, and Representative Franson, and Ms. Erisman, I had a question along with somewhat related to that, and that is that I think you mentioned in your presentation that about it being not transmissible with sex if they have their if the viral load is undetectable. But what about through pregnancy and so on? I mean, is that also cannot be transmitted if someone's viral load is undetectable at that point? Or is it only that it can't be transmitted sexually, or do we have data on that? Ms. Erisman.
Madam Chair, the emphasis is on sexual transmission, and that's what the studies focused on. And let me just, we have a statement about pregnancy, so let me just Does this U equals U or undetectable equals untransmissible apply to injection drug use or perinatal transmission? And no, at this point there's not enough data to support making a statement. Now clearly if an individual's viral load is decreased to the levels that it is, we would expect that wouldn't happen, but there aren't scientific studies at this point that would support that, so we can't say that.
Okay, and just to close the loop on that, I assume that studies are probably ongoing on this area. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, I mean, this is something that's still being looked at. And then just to if I could, to speak to Representative Franson's question. The studies that looked at the sexual transmission, they were serodiscordant couples, which meant that one partner was positive, one was negative. There were over 3,500 couples and 150,000 sex acts and no transmission, just to put it in perspective in terms of numbers.
Right, right. Thank you very much. That's quite an accomplishment from some years ago when this epidemic first arose, right, to have this ability to suppress the virus this way. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted more clarity when it comes to African-American and African-born. If you can really aggregate the data, what is the rate of AIDS in those two communities?
Ms. Erisman.
Madam Chair and Representative Noor, if we look at, for instance, for African-born women, one of every two new HIV cases were among black African-born women. So 47% of the cases were occurring in that population. So that's clearly disproportionate. For African-American women, it was at 24%, also disproportionate. If we look at in men, one in every four new HIV cases were among African American men, 28%. So certainly our African born communities are dealing with this at a much higher level than their representation in the population.
Representative Neuer?
We'll have a follow up later on. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. I'm not seeing any further questions. I guess I just have one more for you, Ms. Erisman. I was hoping that we might have somebody here from DHS to talk about this as well. I'm not sure if we do. I don't have that on my agenda here. But
there are individuals from DHS who are here.
Who can speak to this also? Okay, that's great. Because I am understanding that DHS as well as MDH do some work in this area, and I just wanted us to be clear about what that is, how it's different, why we're doing this in two different places in our state government. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Darren Rolls. I am the HIV Supports Manager with the Department of Human Services. The significant distinction in the work that happens at Health versus Human Services is that the work at the Department of Human Services is funded through Ryan White legislation, and the focus of that legislation is providing core medical and support services for people living with HIV. So the focus of that work is for people living with HIV, where Health is able to do comprehensive prevention programming that targets communities and individuals at risk for HIV who aren't living with HIV.
Okay, and Mr. Rolls, you said, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and so it does sound like there's some crossover, however, because part of what Health is focusing on is people, at least in the presentation, people who are already infected, right? So
yes.
Are there some activities that are taking place in both places, Mr. Rolls?
Madam Chair, there is definite crossover, and part of the goal of the statewide strategy is to increase the coordination between the state partners. So currently, the Department of Human Services and MDH have collaborative relationships where we subcontract elements of our programming elements of our funding to support the programming that each entity is most skilled at offering. So some of the more prevention-oriented services, including prevention with positive folks, some of the money that comes into the state for Ryan White services goes to the Department of Health to administer.
I see. Ms. Erisman.
Madam Chair, so, for instance, the HIV strategy was a joint effort between our two agencies. We just had a meeting yesterday, and our staff are meeting regularly to coordinate our work in these areas. So, yes, I happen to be the presenter, but the work is definitely being done by both agencies.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's good to know. You're ahead of the question.
Yes.
That's great. All right. Well, any questions from members for these two testifiers? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So we can move to our very first bill in the committee, Representative Cantrell, House File 269. So Representative Cantrell moves that House File 269 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus in our division bill. Representative Cantrell, go ahead and introduce your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Today I'm presenting House File 269, and it's a bill that will appropriate $1 million in fiscal year 2020 and $1 million in fiscal year 2021 for the Commissioner of Health to award award grants to organizations that have experience in working to reduce the transmission and prevalence of HIV and AIDS in the state of Minnesota. The grants will be awarded on a request and application basis. And I don't want to be too redundant with the information that was provided by Director Ayersman, but I want to say that prevention is absolutely key to our overall, I think, public health strategy, as we've seen new cases of HIV in Minnesota remain fairly steady over the past decade at about 300 cases per year. And these cases are distributed throughout the state of Minnesota. The highest concentration geographically that we see is within the city of Minneapolis and the seven county metro suburb area. But of course, there are cases across the state of Minnesota. We know that it affects all of our communities. And if individuals are who do end up being diagnosed with HIV have access to treatment early, it can really be a huge difference in the quality of life and the longevity that they are able to pursue as a result of that maintenance treatment and as a result of being able to access really essential medications. And I do want to draw a distinction. AIDS is different from HIV in the fact that AIDS is an advanced kind of progression of someone who has contracted HIV. It essentially is a point at which the body's immune system can no longer really protect against opportunistic infections and cancers, and that is a point in time when really an individual is in most severe danger. But if someone's HIV infection is identified early, if treatment is began early, then that individual can live nearly equivalent to the time or a nearly equivalent lifespan as somebody who does not have HIV. So we've really made incredible strides in kind of the newer medical treatments and technologies that we have available to address the transmission and prevent the transmission of HIV and to make sure that individuals who do have HIV or AIDS are able to live long and really fulfilling and happy and healthy lives. So I'm joined by a couple of testifiers today, and I want to thank Director Ayersman for her presentation. I'm joined by Cree Gordon, who is the HIV Prevention Coordinator from the Youth and AIDS Project, and Matt Tuberin, Director of Public Policy at Justice Health. And they'll be able to kind of talk a little bit more about some of the work that their organizations are doing, but there's a lot of really incredible work going on in the state of Minnesota, working to address epidemic of HIV and AIDS in our state, but we as a legislature really need to make an earnest investment if we are to truly achieve the goals outlined by Director Ayersman in her presentation. So with that, Madam Chair, if it's all right with you, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee. Just please give us your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Sounds good. My name is Cree Gordon, and again, I am the HIV Prevention Coordinator at the Youth and AIDS Project. I have been at YAP for about 8 or 9 months now, but I've been doing HIV work for 14 years. Yeah, I know my baby face doesn't show that, but my director often says that youth and young adults who come to YAP don't come to YAP because they slept with the wrong person one night, that there are events that lead them to coming to YAP and accessing our services. Many of our youth who come are often not only dealing with the idea that they might have HIV or gotten HIV or are living with HIV, but they're dealing with a whole slew of other issues such as like poverty and homelessness. Some of our youth are injection drug users. They're dealing with a lot of trauma, right? And I don't have to look far for an example of that. So the way I got into HIV work was 14 years ago. As a 19-year-old, I was a homeless youth and sex worker. And at the time, we have great testing technologies now, right? So youth can, or people can know their status in under a minute with our NCD technology. But at the time, I had to wait 2 weeks for my results. And as a way to get the homeless youth to go back for their results, they would give us a $10 incentive. And my birthday was coming up, so I wanted a Happy Meal and a Reese's, right? And so many people don't think like a Happy Meal can change your life, but one changed mine. And I didn't know much about HIV or prevention. And I see that in all of the young people that I work with on a regular basis. And so having an increase that is being asked would be very beneficial because it would allow us to be a little more innovative in how we're reaching youth and young adults. And I'm sitting here because a large portion, so last year in 2017, we had 284 new infections. 109 of those happened in folks under the age of 30. So it's still very prevalent, like in youth and young adults. A lot of the youth I work with or my new infections or the clients that we serve are youth of color, as you were talking about earlier. And so while we've made strides, we're still seeing new infections in young folks. So I hope you consider the bill being presented in front of you.
All right. Thank you very much. And I know we have members with questions, but I'm going to let the testifiers get through, and then we'll open it up for questions and hope you'll stay and we can have a discussion.
Yes.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Viren, Public Policy Director at Justice Health, a newly formed organization. There's a merger between the Minnesota AIDS Project and the Rainbow Health Initiative. So we serve roughly 3,000 low-income folks living with HIV, several thousand more folks at high risk, and also work on education and advocacy to achieve health equity for LGBTQ communities. It's an honor to be here before you today to testify in support of Representative Cantrell's House File 269. As Benjamin Franklin said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of care, and that is the real purpose of this bill. Given the dramatic progress in HIV/AIDS prevention and care, Minnesota has the opportunity to achieve an end to AIDS. While advances in antiretroviral treatment have dramatically improved the quality of life and length of life for people living with HIV, similar gains have not yet been achieved for HIV prevention. However, with proven prevention strategies for HIV-negative people at high risk for infection and in targeted interventions with HIV-positive individuals who are out of care, we now have the necessary tools to stop and ultimately reverse the epidemic. Inadequate state funding and recent reductions in federal funding for HIV prevention threaten the significant gains Minnesota has made in fighting this epidemic. Minnesota state funding for HIV prevention has remained flat since 1998. And I'll just repeat that one more time. Minnesota's funding for HIV prevention has been flat since 1998, while at the same time our neighboring states like Wisconsin and Colorado have in the last few years increased their investments in HIV prevention, and as a result, their outcomes are surpassing our own, and where Minnesota once was a leader, we are now falling behind. In addition to inadequate state funding, due to changes at the CDC, Minnesota has lost over 40% of our federal prevention funding over roughly the last 7 years. Increased prevention resources for targeted high-impact interventions can be used to quickly test, diagnose, and link to medical care. The estimated 1,000 people in Minnesota who currently are unaware of their status. And in addition, funding is needed to for increased interventions with the 40% of Minnesotans who are living with HIV and are not in treatment to find and link them into care and medications. Increasing activities in these two areas will lead to a significant reduction in new infections across the board. So we have the know-how. We have the tools and ability to close these gaps, but what we lack are the resources. By investing in HIV prevention, we can save Minnesota's taxpayers money, we can save lives, decrease new infections, and we can reduce health disparities that are unacceptable and unjust. With increased prevention, we can continue the vital progress to eliminate HIV in Minnesota, and together we can once and for all end AIDS. So thank you again, Madam Chair and members, for your support for House File 269.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. We have a question from Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for bringing this forward. This is a really great cause. I had a couple of concerns about the bill. I know it's a pretty small text, but the way I read this bill, that you're asking for $2 million in funds for the next 2 years total, how much of the $2 million will the Commissioner of Health charge for administering this program? I've seen other bills, like another one we're hearing today, mm-hmm. where the Commissioner of Health charges 15% of those funds. So if they were to use that same formula, that would be $300,000 that the Commissioner of Health would charge. And they're not actually doing the due here. They're just cutting the checks to nonprofits they choose. Do you know what the percentage is that they'd be charging?
Representative Cantrell, if you want to answer that, otherwise we can call back Ms. Erisman and see if she can answer it for us. But please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Munson, I think I'll defer to Director Erisman. She might be able to answer that question thoroughly.
All right. Ms. Erisman's coming back. Welcome back.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Munson. Just two comments on that. First of all, for resources that we received that were referred to in 1998, the agency takes no money to administer those. Our feeling is that there would be some costs to administer these grants because we do go through a very rigorous RFP process, but we have not fiscal noted this, and so I can't give you a number, but I can assure you that your projection of 15% would be higher than what I would guess just based on staffing needs. So historically, we have not charged in the past, but we recognize that there are some costs, and so we'll have to fiscal note it, but 15% is very high.
Okay.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next question, well, last week we heard a presentation about nonprofit companies being subsidies of for-profit companies and the inverse of that. And I'm just curious, is there would you be willing to take an amendment to this bill that would require that the nonprofit entities receiving these funds would not be subsidiaries of for-profit entities or being able to bill their own company for services so that we understand that the money is being used for its intended purpose? And also I notice in this that it's talking about using the money targeting communities at high risk of HIV infection, but there's nothing in this bill that prevents this money from being dispersed to a non-Minnesota-based nonprofit or going to a national nonprofit where the funds wouldn't even be coming back to this state, which is a concern of mine because, I mean, the largest at-risk communities, maybe you're in Africa or outside of the country even, and there's nothing in this bill that designates the funds that are being granted to a nonprofit to be used for communities in Minnesota, which is a concern of mine, and we have the ability to put some curbs in place on legislation as we create these larger programs, and we want to make sure that we're targeting those services here in Minnesota. I know that on the other side of the aisle especially, there's a lot of concern about, you know, million-dollar CEOs of nonprofits. Is there any caps on what some of these employees of these nonprofits can be paid that run these programs? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Munson. That's a really good question, and it's one that I've never heard in connection with any of this, but I think it's a very valid question. I just wonder if maybe staff can help us with that, because I wonder if there's, you know, when you get a bill like this, it's just one little section, but it also it goes into a statute where there's some context in there, and I wonder if Ms. Clarkvist can help us if there are any guardrails around any of that or if this has ever come up as an issue. Ms. Clarkvist?
Madam Chair and Representative Munson, so actually this is not placed in a statute. This is uncoded language. It's just appropriation language. So there's nothing that this is going to be placed into. There might be administrative requirements at health that would govern nonprofits that are eligible for these grants and Minnesota-based populations.
Mm-hmm. And Ms. Erisman, do you know, are there guardrails around this, as Representative Munson is asking about, that require that these kinds of funds stay in Minnesota, that they I know the department administers these and takes RFPs and so on. Does the department require that the RFPs be for populations in Minnesota? Are there any requirements around what kinds of organizations can be eligible for these funds?
Madam Chair, in the past, and as we've administered grants to organizations, they have all been Minnesota-based organizations that serve Minnesotans, and we're quite specific in looking at what the epidemiology of HIV is, what populations are at greatest risk, and then making sure that the resources are allocated accordingly. So in other words, if 50% of the cases occurred in a certain community, then the resources would be allocated like that. I certainly can say that we don't have a problem with having those guardrails put in place, because we certainly have never funded, you know, an international outside entity or someone that's serving populations other than Minnesota populations.
Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I haven't looked at this recently, but I vaguely remember back in my legislative career that the Department of Administration has a grants management office that, and I think it's guided by some statutes that directs state agencies and how to run these RFP programs and solicit responses, and they train the people in the various state agencies. And for those, Representative Munson and others who are interested, you might want to explore with them that process. But I know there is some overall guidance.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Loeffler. And Ms. Clark, maybe, I'm sure you're probably taking notes on this anyway, but maybe you can, when you get a chance, give us a little more of the landscape around this, because I think it is a very good question and one that we want to make sure always that our money is going where we hope it's going. But Ms. Erisman, I wonder then, I wanted to ask you, I'm glad you came back to the table. Could you just give us a little thumbnail of where the funds are coming from right now that are going to this HIV work? And it was said that it hasn't been increased since 1998. I mean, is there an ongoing appropriation for this? Is it just part of the base funding of the Department of Health, or are there federal funds? You know, if you know, I don't know. I know you didn't come prepared to give us that information today, but I would kind of like to know what the background is for the work that we're already doing.
Madam Chair, yes, there was an appropriation specifically for HIV prevention, and as was discussed, that has not changed since 1998. We also do add some federal funds to that so that we can expand the reach, but the majority of the funding is state funds that were appropriated in 1998. I mean, that originally were appropriated in 1998 and continue to be appropriated in each biennium.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, members? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Grunhagen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, this is a question for Ms. Ernstman. Is that the correct pronunciation? Well, anyway, when we give out these RFPs, do we ask for, to these nonprofits, do we ask for a report back as to what the money was spent on and what was actually accomplished?
Ms. Erisman.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, yes. We have grants managers that meet with each of the grantees, and they have objectives, and we're checking in on their expenses and things like that. So if they're not meeting the objectives that we've set out for them, if there are issues, we can rescind the grant. And you may want to hear from a grantee to tell you what it's like to receive funds if you'd like to know a little bit more.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I mean, does the money come in a lump sum, or does it come over a period of time, or generally, or does it depend on the RFP?
Ms. Erisman.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, the grantee will invoice us, so no, it's not a lump sum. What we do is we set up a grant with them or a contract that says that, you know, we are setting aside X amount of dollars, $50,000 or whatever, for your program. And then we work with them, and each month they are reporting in what they're accomplishing and then submitting invoices. And so there's definitely a check and balance. There's no sort of here's your money, you know, have a good time with it.
Uh-huh. And Mr. Gordon, would you want to just comment? I know there's, if you would pull the mic back and just let us know what is it like for your organization as a grantee.
Sure, Madam Chair. So it was funny, Representative, when you were asking the question, I was like nodding my head really hard, I realized, because I'm one of the people who writes the report, and depending on what the grant is and who I have it from, whether it's like MDH or DHS, we actually write pretty frequently. And so, like, I know for me and my testing grant, I do two reports a year every 6 months, and then the grant I get for PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, I have to do 4 a year. And so we're checking in pretty frequently. We have calls. I oftentimes like talk to the folks over at DHS and MDH, because I'm also part of the Minnesota HIV Planning Council. So yeah, it's an ongoing thing, I think. And if I can add, I think what some of this money will do is help us with the program. Like, it sounds like a lot, but once you start getting into the cost of some of the things that we have to deal with HIV, that money goes very quickly. So, like, for example, I can help, like, link someone to PrEP, and I can even find them funds to pay for the actual prescription. But where I don't have funds or where I don't have support is them seeing the doctor every 3 months, because that's required to be on PrEP, and I don't have funds to help them pay for their lab costs if, like, they haven't met their deductible for their insurance. And so, like, and those things can be very, like, expensive. So while that sum sounds like a lot, as the we have all these interventions, but the cost of these interventions are very expensive. So and most of us, because there was also the question about how do we, like, regulate to make sure, like, we aren't, like, frivolously, like, spending this, or, like, folks who are in leadership roles, like myself, aren't frivolously spending it. It's, I didn't get into this to make money. I got into this so folks wouldn't have to experience what I had to experience, right? And so I sometimes I'm living check to check myself, right? And so we don't do this, like, for a living. We really are doing this to, like, support the folks in our communities.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mm-hmm. Gordon. And okay, so are there any other questions for members? Okay, oh, I guess I do have one more question, Ms. Erisman. We're talking about these drugs that a person has to take for the rest of their life, essentially, and I just wonder if you could give us a sense, since we're talking about prevention and lifetime treatment for somebody who gets infected. What is the cost of the drugs that, can you just give us a general idea of, I'm just thinking about, you know, the cost benefit of preventing someone from ever getting infected versus having to treat them for their entire life.
Madam Chair, actually, as you were discussing the program, I was thinking that there are some estimates that lifetime costs for someone who's infected with HIV are about $300,000. So, you know, $1 million program is just slightly more than preventing 3 cases of HIV. But I'll let Mr. Gordon also comment.
Yeah, and that $300,000 is a very conservative estimate, right? So, if I didn't have insurance and help from our state's AIDS drug assistance program, my medicine alone would cost $3,000. So that's roughly $36,000 a year. So that $300,000 wouldn't even cover the cost of 10 years of my life for just the medicine. That doesn't include, like, all the other costs that comes with living with HIV. And the thing is, when the biomedical intervention PrEP came around, it wasn't meant to, like, be taken for, like, the long haul or, like, the entirety of someone's life. It's to give them a tool for a short stint in their life if they just feel like they need the extra protection. Truvada costs roughly $1,500 a month if they can't cover the cost via insurance or other methods of, like, co-pays. And so we do see that, like, there really is a cost benefit of helping folks prevent HIV because it's expensive to treat. The drugs itself is probably the most expensive thing, but there are other costs that come with living with HIV as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much, the testifiers. And final question, Representative Munson.
Yeah, my question, Madam Chair, is if I'm able to make a friendly amendment to this bill to add Minnesota-based in front of the word nonprofit, and to add Minnesota in front of the word communities to this bill so that we ensure that these funds would stay with these great nonprofits mm-hmm. that are testifying today, not these specific ones, but ones like these, to prevent future potential of this money going out of the state or out of the country.
So, Representative Munson, are you moving an oral amendment?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, so Representative Munson is moving an oral amendment, and would you please restate the amendment so that we can get that all down?
That would be to use the words Minnesota-based in front of the words...
Okay, what line are you on?
Line 1.6, Minnesota-based in front of the word nonprofit. And to add the word Minnesota in front of on line 1.7 in front of the word communities.
Okay, so Representative Cantrell, did you understand the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I did, and I'm in favor of it.
All right, so Representative Cantrell, would you want to just incorporate that into your bill?
Yes,
Madam Chair. Can we ask questions on the oral amendment?
Certainly, you can, Representative Olson.
Okay. I just thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I had a question. I hear that money doesn't go out, but does this change? I mean, there are nonprofits that operate across the United States that have local, you know, affiliates that do this work. Or I just don't want to have right. I feel like this was a little quick, and maybe you had discussion offline. I don't know if you had discussion offline with Representative Munson about this, but I don't want to have unintended consequences with language that I just am cautious that there are Minnesota communities too. I mean, if people receive health care, I just would want to not have unintended consequences and want to make sure that Representative Munson had talked with Representative Cantrell before this.
Uh-huh. Other questions, members, comments? Representative Schultz?
I don't know if I, thank you, Madam Chair, I don't know if I like the word based, because you could have something headquartered in Minnesota and chapters or facilities outside of Minnesota, so I don't know if that addresses the concerns mm-hmm. from Representative Munson completely, so could just say Minnesota. Nonprofit organizations in that line 1.6.
Okay, well, Representative Cantrell, do you have any other? So it sounds like we probably need to vote on the amendment. Unless Representative Munson, do you want to stick with what you got here, or do you want to alter your motion?
Madam Chair, I would accept the amendment to the amendment.
So you're moving an oral amendment, and what does the oral amendment say at this point?
Adding the word Minnesota in front of the word nonprofit, and adding the word Minnesota in front of the word communities on line 1.7.
Okay, so does everybody have that? So Representative Munson is moving to, on line 1.6, to add the word Minnesota before the word nonprofit, and on line 1.7 to add the word Minnesota before the word communities. Is there a discussion to that amendment? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and could we hear from the department to make sure that there's not going to be unintended consequences or if there's any concern?
Absolutely. Ms. Erisman, do you want to comment?
Madam Chair and Representative Halverson, I don't anticipate that there would be a problem. I was commenting to my colleague here sort of tongue-in-cheek that we need to come back to you and report what progress has been made in Minnesota, and that's a real incentive to keep the resources here, because if we gave it to someone else, we wouldn't be able to tell you that we had made improvement in Minnesota. So I don't have a problem with these proposed changes.
Okay, so it's a little bit belt and suspenders I'm hearing. But, and members, this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division bill. So today is not the last day that we can work on this. But, you know, there is a motion before us to add this language. And is there any other, Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to proper grammar, we might want to say grants to nonprofit organizations in Minnesota targeting communities in Minnesota rather than Minnesota communities or Minnesota nonprofits.
Representative Munson.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Who was it, Elizabeth?
Ms. Clarkfist.
Ms. Clarkfist brought to my attention that it actually should say on line 1.8 for Minnesota individuals living with HIV/AIDS. It's the
Okay, so Representative Munson, why don't you restate your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The motion is to add the word Minnesota.
At nonprofit organizations in Minnesota.
Minnesota. And it would say on line 1.7, targeting communities at risk for HIV infection for Minnesota. So adding the word Minnesota in front of individuals on line 1.8 living with HIV/AIDS.
Or the individuals living in Minnesota.
Okay. Okay, for individuals, I would accept that. For individuals living in Minnesota with HIV/AIDS. You English professor?
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair Elizabeth, Ms. Clarkvist could.
Ms. Clarkvist, can you give us the, why don't you read back the oral amendment as you understand it?
Madam Chair, I guess I would suggest on 1.6 say nonprofit organizations in Minnesota. So add in Minnesota after organizations. On 1.7, I would add in Minnesota after communities. And on 1.8, I would add in Minnesota after individuals.
Okay, so does everybody have that? And Representative Munson, is that your motion?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair.
Okay, does anyone need that restated?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and is Ms. Erisman, is that still something that sounds agreeable to the department?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay, and Representative Cantrell, do you want to incorporate that language into your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Representative Cantrell incorporates, or we still have the motion. All right, so we still have the motion. So we'll vote on the motion. Okay, so the motion is on line 1.6, after organizations, insert the words in Minnesota. On line 1.7, after communities, insert the words in Minnesota. And on line 1.8, after the word individuals, insert in Minnesota. Have I got that right, Ms. Clarkvist?
Yes.
Okay. So we're all about in Minnesota in this amendment three times. Okay, we want to make darn sure that it's in Minnesota. All right, all those in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Okay, the motion prevails, and that amendment is adopted. And with that, thank you very much. Seeing no further discussion, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in the division bill. Thank you very much, Representative Cantrell and testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you,
folks. Okay. The next bill is House File 479. Representative Becker Finn. And I will move that House File 479 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division bill. Representative Becker Finn, welcome to the committee, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 479 would establish a competitive grant program for domestic violence and sexual assault prevention. And keeping in mind that this is a finance committee, the ask is for $5 million over the biennium, so it would be split evenly, $2.5 million each year in 2020 and 2021, and it would be funded with general fund dollars. And I have quite a few testifiers here that I know want to share why this is so important. For those of you who don't know, in my other job, I am a prosecutor in Hennepin County, and I work exclusively on domestic violence cases. This bill is unique because we're here in the HHS committee and not in the public safety committee. So this is looking at domestic violence and sexual assault from a public health perspective and how we can better prevent domestic violence and sexual assault from occurring in our communities, as opposed to looking at it as a criminal justice issue after the fact. And so with that, I want to make sure we have plenty of time for testifiers and happy to take any questions at any point, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. And I know, Representative Munson, you already have a question. Is it something brief that we can get our to our testifiers?
Madam Chair, I just had a question on the scope of the bill. It concerns me that the public safety issue is being put under the public health issue. And just right off the top when I read the bill, my concern was about the focus of where the funds are going, and would it be possible for, after the Department of Health, the Commissioner of Health takes their $750,000 cut, that the money just be given to like a national, and what's it called, Anytown USA or gun prevention organization to prevent prevent violence in the home? And is there, is it specifically have to, I mean, the wide range of activities that this funds could be used for are concerning. There doesn't seem to be real tight curbs on this.
So, Representative Munson, I think we're going to allow Representative Becker-Finn and her testifiers to present, and then if your questions are not answered, we can entertain the questions. But I think we should allow her and her testifiers to present the bill in the form that they would like. So please go ahead.
Yep. Madam Chair, I'm not sure who we have first on the on your list.
I have John Choi, if he's
and ready. He may be testifying in another committee right now. If we could move to our second.
Anybody that you'd like. Katie Kramer, Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Katie Kramer, Policy Director for the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We're a statewide coalition with 93 member programs who provide advocacy and services to domestic and sexual violence victim survivors in all 87 Minnesota counties. I'm testifying in support of HF 479, the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Prevention Bill. Minnesota has a long history of financially supporting domestic and sexual violence work. However, there's an alarming shortage of funding for prevention efforts in the state. Our current funding model provides governmental dollars for crisis intervention, advocacy, and services for victims. While funding to support services for victim survivors in crisis is necessary, it's also critical that we address the root causes of violence as a means to stop future violence either from happening again or from happening at all. We've been doing domestic violence work here in Minnesota for 40 years, long enough that we are now hearing this tragic story. Advocates in our domestic violence programs tell us that the young boys who were once in shelter with their mothers are now appearing in court as perpetrators of domestic violence. It's imperative that communities across the state gain greater access to prevention education and information. We know that 1 in 4 adult women will experience domestic violence during their lifetime. Here in Minnesota, more than 55,000 adults receive services from the domestic violence programs each year. And we also know that less than 50% of the people who experience domestic violence ever reach out for services. We also know that domestic and sexual violence is associated with negative health and economic consequences, including injury and death, missed days of work or school, and both long and short-term physical and mental health conditions. Based on a 2018 report from the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence, the lifetime cost of intimate partner violence to Minnesota is over $66 billion. The cost over a lifetime for an individual victim of intimate partner violence is $103,767 for women and $23,414 for men. This cost analysis is calculated through the medical cost, loss of productivity, criminal justice systems cost, and property loss. This does not include the cost and impact on family and friends. Domestic and sexual violence is very costly for individuals, family, government, and society as a whole. The impact goes well beyond the financial costs. We must ensure that all victims in Minnesota have a place to turn for help while also investing in prevention programming in order to protect lives, reduce harm, and save money. Minnesota has a history of innovative and effective programming and strategies to respond to and prevent domestic and sexual violence. MCBW works on one such prevention initiative, working with public health care providers to improve the response to domestic and sexual violence in the context of adolescent relationships. MCBW's clinic project has been evaluated by the University of Minnesota's Nursing School and found to be effective. Through this work, we learned that 41.2% of youth being seen in health clinics in the metro area have experienced physical or sexual violence. 41.2%. MCBW trained healthcare providers in 5 teen clinics on dating violence and a universal screening protocol where every patient at every visit is talked with about healthy and unhealthy relationships. Among young women who received the intervention from their healthcare provider, they were 60% more likely to end a relationship because it felt unsafe or unhealthy. 93% of the surveyed youth agree that this is helpful for providers to talk to them about healthy and unhealthy relationships. The numbers tell you one thing. The voices of youth illustrate this prevention work. These are just two quotations echoed by many youth. From a 19-year-old young woman, she says, "Some of us don't grow up in a home where our parents have a healthy relationship. If we don't see it at home, how can we grow up to have a healthy relationship? I want someone to talk to me. I want to be healthy." From a 17-year-old girl, "It's so important that nurses and teachers talk to us about relationships. I mean, they need to be upfront and real with us. If they don't talk to us, TVs, movies, and music just send us messed up messages. We want and need real education." MCBW's youth clinic program is just one example of the importance and impact of that funding for prevention programming can have on Minnesota's youth for future generations. Minnesota needs to invest in community-driven, culturally relevant prevention programming in order to do more than just respond to crisis, but to prevent domestic and sexual violence from occurring in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let us go on to the next testifier, and please stay around in case there are any questions. I'm sure you will anyway. But do you... Representative Beckerfin, do you want to call your next testifier? Or do you want
to just... Madam Chair, Nicole Matthews.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Okay. Bujun Denewe Maganang, Nicole Matthews, Jaganashimung, Manidu Baneshikwe Indigo, Migizi Indo Dame. Greetings, everyone. My name is Nicole Matthews. My English name is Nicole Matthews, and my Indian name is Spirit Bird Woman, and I'm from the Wider Fan of Ojibwe. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Indian Women Sexual Assault Coalition. We're a statewide tribal coalition and a national tribal technical assistance provider. And our members include representation from every tribe here in Minnesota and include many of the urban areas in Minnesota as well. We have both individual and organizational members. And we have been around for about 18 years. Our organization specifically provides technical assistance and organizing around addressing sexual violence and sex trafficking against our tribal communities. Gender-based violence against our Native relatives is high. In fact, 1 out of 3 Native women will be raped in her lifetime. And Native women suffer the highest rates of violent victimization in the country, yet prevention funding is very hard to come by. Culturally-based prevention strategies are critical in addressing gender-based violence. Next week in Bemidji, we will host our second Native Men's Summit because we know that in order to prevent gender-based violence, we must also engage men in the dialogue and solutions. At our first men's summit, we had 178 people registered, and only 34 were women. So we know that there are men in Minnesota, Native men specifically, who are engaged and ready to talk about these issues and to do more in our communities. In addition, we have held 13 Native girls camps, 2 Native boys camps, where we incorporate cultural teachings into prevention work with both girls and boys. We have had girls who have come every single year and have come back as mentors to other girls. We have had girls who have left our girls' retreats and come to the Capitol and spoken at the Capitol to talk about their concerns in our communities, where we are building leadership. Our members have held regalia-making events, round dances, powwows. They've held honor songs, cultural camps, and more in their efforts to build strong communities and prevent gender-based violence in their respective communities. Most of these efforts are not state or federally funded due to restrictions on prevention, and yet we're still holding them, and our communities are still making efforts to bring prevention to their community. It is critical to the well-being of our communities here in Minnesota that we not only continue to fund direct services to victims, but also community-based prevention strategies to end gender-based violence, where we can continue being a leader as we have been on this issue in Minnesota. Miigwech, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We will hold the questions until the end here. So, Representative Becker-Finn.
Madam Chair, Ms. Cole.
Ms. Cole? Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name for the record and go ahead and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Pethula Floor Cole, and I am the Executive Director of Oasis of Love Crisis Intervention Center. I'm here today to speak to you about the urgent need for community-driven and culturally relevant programming to prevent domestic violence and sexual assault in the state of Minnesota. For those of you who might be less familiar with Oasis of Love Crisis Intervention, we're located in North Minneapolis and have been working in the community for over 30 years, serving primarily African-American and African heritage individuals that have been impacted by domestic violence and sexual assault. We have been established to help combat the challenges of domestic violence with a firm commitment to preserving the family unit, serving men, women, and children. And we are working to heal individuals, empower people, restore families, and strengthen community. Given my background as a victim survivor and as a woman of color in a relationship with a man of color, my experiences have been different than that of a white male or white female relationship. And during those times when therapy or counseling was suggested, we were put before white counterparts or white therapists that did not understand our needs, nor did the counseling or support help because there was no connecting. They didn't understand our backgrounds. They didn't understand our cultural relevance and how we did or why we did the things that we did as it related to family and cultural structure. And for that relationship, it was very tumultuous and volatile, and so we decided to split. And as I continue this work as a victim survivor and as I began to work towards my healing process, I went through an organization. It was not culturally specific to what I looked like or what I needed, and I was re-victimized. It was hard to work through the advocacy process, even though I know I needed the support and help. I did get some. However, I had to fight for myself in that sense. What happened is my advocate could not understand why I did not want my son or my daughter separated or put in a system because it was not relative or helpful for us to thrive in certain situations that were offered to me. I think at some point I was looked at because I was one in a shelter needing services and support and a woman of color that I was not educated or that I did not deserve or have a need for certain things that people that were not of color needed. And so therefore I was not given the best support or services that I should have been given, and I learned how to advocate for myself and others that look like me. What I do know is every 7 seconds a woman is subjected to violence, domestic violence that is. And we know that 1 in 4 women are physically abused. And so in this room, unfortunately, we have women here that have been abused. And we need to decrease those numbers. In my role as executive director, I know that we as a community have gotten used to the Band-Aid approach to advocacy. We spend a lot of time and a lot of resources rebuilding confidence in family structures that have been broken due to abuse. We see a lot of the same cases year over year and wonder, and we ask ourselves, is this really working? We want and need the ability to prevent the cycle of violence, and that is why we're asking for prevention. We know there are solutions to prevent future violence in our community, and at Oasis of Love, we do have programs that take a look at the abuser. We have a men's program called In Him, where we take the abuser or the aggressive back to the beginning, and we work through the heart of their traumatic experiences to help them understand why they abuse and how to heal after the abuse and trauma they've suffered. We work with the aggressors to hold them accountable for their actions, and we've seen great results. Now we have several men that come and volunteer to our men's program to help other men that are going through the same things that they faced in their past to say, we're banding together to end violence. We understand that things have happened to us in our childhood or in our youth that has caused us to be aggressive or to be violent and abusive to others. And so we continue to work with our men's program, and they have accountability coaches and that are helping them heal from their past trauma, and it's because of that prevention work. And what we find oftentimes is that the families are broken. We're supporting the women, and we're supporting the children, but we're not helping the men. And in the state of Minnesota, prevention care is far few and in between, and we need to get to the heart of the matter. As service providers, we do understand that children exposed to violence or sexual trauma are at a greater risk for substance abuse, juvenile pregnancy, criminal behaviors, and other unhealthy vices. We know and studies have shown that children from violent homes exhibit more aggressive behaviors and have the tendency to operate in the same manners of that what they've witnessed. We are providing our clients the tools they need to heal and move toward healthy lifestyles free from abuse, but we need help. We need the voices of legislators. We need the voices of our community. We need the voices of faith-based organizations for culturally relevant, a community approach to prevention. I can say that because communities of color, not only African American or African heritage, but Latina, but Asian, we have a faith-based belief that the cultures go to those places for help. The faith-based organization and different resources and tools we use may look differently than those that are not communities of color. And so we need to begin to partner together with these organizations within our own communities, looking across the table with people that look like us, where we're feeling more comfortable to share our stories, and we see those numbers begin to decrease in violence.
Ms. Cole, if I could just... We have about 10 minutes left in the committee hearing, and
absolutely.
I know we have a couple more testifiers, so if you could just finish up real quickly.
Absolutely.
Here. Thank you.
And so I ask that you support the House File 479 and Senate File 608 with these vital resources. We can support community-driven and culturally relevant prevention programming to stop the cycle of domestic violence and sexual assault. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. I see Mr. Choi is here, and we have Ms. Vang as well. Who should go next?
Madam Chair, Ramsey County Attorney John Choi.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Choi, and please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Choi. I serve as the Ramsey County Attorney, and I am just very excited to be here to support House File 479. I want to thank Representative Becker Finn for championing this bill, because I think it's so critical. I spend a lot of my time, in fact, I've had the great honor and privilege of being able to be in charge of a public law office in the St. Paul City Attorney's Office and now the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, but we're really, on the criminal prosecution side of things, we're downstream. We're responding to problems. You know, the worst things that happen in society, they come right to my desk and we have to deal with them, right? And on the issue of gender-based violence and the issues that this bill is trying to address, I think it's so critical that we are thinking about trying to get upstream and trying to prevent these things from happening in the first place. You know, as a society, we will do an excellent job of all. Once we figure out that we have gaps or issues that we need to improve on, we will always respond and figure out solutions for the problems to respond to them, right? But we always forget, I think, too often to think about how, what are the root causes? How do we address some of these issues so we don't have these issues? You know, we could fill up Target Stadium 17 times over, and that would represent all the women and girls in the state of Minnesota who have at one point in their life been a victim of rape, stalking, or domestic violence. That's a lot of people. But I think that the solutions oftentimes are found amidst the problems. And if we think about those numbers, the vast, vast majority of those perpetrators are men. And I don't say that to indict men. I say it as an invitation for all of us to think about this really important conversation about how we raise boys, right, and how we think about defining what is healthy and respectful manhood. And I think some of those types of initiatives, those conversations that we have in families, within our places of worship and in our communities, and those programs that we could come up with could really be benefited by this type of leadership that I see here to make these types of appropriations and really try to end these things, because at the end of the day, what we're doing good is responding to them, but we really need to figure out a way to end all of this. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Choi, and we have Ms. Vang as well. Thank you for your patience, and we would love to hear from you as well. Please just give us your name for the record and go ahead.
Hi, Madam Chair, members. Good afternoon. My name is Kopa Vang. I'm here at the invitation of the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans to share with you my experiences with domestic violence and sexual assaults, and as to why I believe there should be programs available to educate individuals and families who might someday find themselves in abusive situations or simply help survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. There were many unfortunate incidents that occurred in my life as a young girl. I witnessed my father hit, kick, push, spit on, verbally threaten, and mentally and physically, emotionally, and even spiritually cut down my mother often. As a five-year-old, I remember crying and begging my father for what seemed like hours to stop yelling at and spitting on my mother's face and head. He ripped away her self-esteem, confidence, and self-worth every time he was unhappy or unsatisfied with her. He broke her heart and her spirit numerous times, and I remembered as a little girl all the times my mother would take most of us, about seven of us children, with her to stay with relatives, sometimes for weeks. Of course, we always went back home to my father because a Hmong wife's place is only with her husband. In the Hmong community, divorce equals deep disgrace and loss of face. Where could a mother of 10 children turn to for permanent refuge? She was unable to get help for over two decades. In early 1987, she finally was assisted by social services to flee her abuser along with nine of her children. But negative experiences with a man in my life spilled over from one to another. My first sexual assault occurred in the third grade, shortly before my parents separated. I was fondled by a reading assistant multiple times, and I had no idea what to do. I always wondered if he hurt other children too. I now believe I know the answer. At 10 years old, an 18-year-old acquaintance of my older brother coerced me into having sex with him. All I wanted to do was hang out with older, cooler kids and have fun. I didn't realize this was rape for many years. I blame myself a lot for being there where he was that night. Honestly, I only grew to be more fearful of sex, but luck was not a real friend of mine. At 11 years old, I was kidnapped and raped twice by the same man who later seemed to have an infatuation with me. I didn't even know what to do. A few months later, I was almost gang raped by a notorious group of thugs. I didn't know where to turn to except for the cops. But I was too scared due to threats made by the perpetrators. They threatened to hurt me and my family if I reported them. Sex was a taboo topic. How could I dare speak of any of this to my mother, the only main adult in my life at the time who actually cared about me? I suffered in silence until adulthood by keeping all these secrets to myself. This is my first time ever speaking out about this in my life.
know I have to do this for others so they don't feel what I went through and they don't feel the pain that I have. We never spoke about sex at home, school, or anywhere. I often thought as I got older, if only someone had taught me about sexual assaults and what to do if it occurs, or how to be empowered and how not to be scared to speak up so justice can be served. I always felt so shameful and guilty for all these things I went through. especially knowing that I could never regain my innocence or my virginity back. I later realized how truly sacred my virginity was, and that how it was only meant for my husband. This type of knowledge could have saved a lot of people from the pain I went through and the scars I live with. When I went to college and had my own child, I gained more clarity in life. I decided that I was going to do my best to ensure that my child and other children were aware of what sexual assault was and what to do if they ever encountered it or know someone who did. Education and awareness was key. Sadly, I didn't need to educate them on domestic violence because it was still quite a common theme in many of our lives, and they were used to seeing it from a very young age. I believe that prevention programs, if funded, can educate children from a young age how to have healthy relationships with themselves and others, and to be loving and respectful to themselves and to others. Studies have shown that the majority of domestic violence and sexual assaults have been committed by males towards females. I learned through education and my own personal experiences that if we can shape boys' perspectives of girls from a young age, then we can affect positive changes in how men view women. Girls can be taught self-empowerment skills, all of which can help lower the cases of domestic violence and sexual assaults. It is important that we as a community teach boys to value and respect their female counterparts. There is a great need for programs to assist people who are witnessing abuse and sexual assault, and for survivors of these horrendous acts. Community members must know that they do have readily accessible resources to help them avoid and to overcome their circumstances, and that they can heal from it while moving forward positively in life. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you my own experiences, and as a result, my perspective on the need for domestic violence and sexual assault prevention programs. I ask you that you all support the House File 479, Senate File 608. We could save so many people from the pain I have had to live with, and in the process, we could possibly also save lives. Thank you.
Ms. Vang, thank you very much for sharing with us today. We really appreciate it, and thank you very much for that. So we are at the end of our time. We are going to go 5 more minutes because I do want to allow members to ask a few questions. The bill will be laid over, which does mean that there will be another opportunity to discuss some of this. But Representative Munson, do you want to ask your question now?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've got 3 questions on the bill, concerns that I have. Because it's really addressing violence prevention or crime prevention here and making it a public health issue, the potential for these funds to be used for lobbying efforts against gun rights is really, you've opened the door with this bill, and I have concerns around that. It's not specifically called out that it doesn't allow funds to be given to a lobbying firm to be used, and I have the same concerns about the first bill we discussed. There's nothing in here that prevents the money to be given to violence prevention efforts or nationwide organization. You also write in the bill that it can be the money received by a nonprofit can be used to work collaboratively with other for-profit organizations, which is concerning. The 15% that the commissioner can spend of these $5 million funds, which turns out to be $750,000, and you call out in this document that you would hire one full-time employee, which is up to $375,000 a year. That's a Minnesota employee. That isn't including the employees at the nonprofits. I just have concerns around, again, guardrails that we could put in this legislation to make it better so that the monies being allocated from this program can be better served, you know, in the communities in Minnesota and to be used for other items besides, you know, gun prevention And specifically in, on page 2, where they list the items.
President Munson, can you ask a question so that she can answer it?
Okay.
Could you do that, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I just have a question on the, when you talk about the develop culturally inappropriate domestic violence and sexual assault prevention programs, does that include things like female genital mutilation and these types of acts that that we would look for funding or perhaps look for funding as well?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So first, if you read line 1.12, the entire purpose of this is that we're looking at community-driven programs. So community-driven means community-based. It doesn't mean national organization. That's the whole point of this bill. The guardrails, those are really far off the road, some of the suggestions you've made. There is a requirement that a report would be made to the legislature, to the legislative committee with jurisdiction over health, about the way that the funds would be spent, how many people would be helped. And then if you also look, there is a list here of 93 different member organizations through the Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women, as well as more than 60 member organizations through the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. So those 153-plus organizations would be the type of organizations that these funds would be going to. If you look through here, you probably, nearly everybody in this committee can probably find one of these organizations that's serving constituents in your own communities. So the whole point of community-driven programming and culturally relevant programming, as we heard from the testifiers here, it's a lot more powerful and has a better chance of making a difference when people are served by folks who look like them and who understand their cultural background and experiences.
All right, Representative Munson, let me just say, members, I have a couple more members on the list. If we don't finish the bill, we'll come back at 7 o'clock. So if you'd like to do that, I'm happy to do it, and I'm sure Representative Becker-Finn can be here. We got all the testimony, and so go ahead, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those are all the questions I have.
All right, Representative Cranston.
I have an amendment. Elizabeth, would you... Can you hand that out and explain the amendment?
Well, Representative Franson, if you're going to do an amendment, then I think since we're about done with our committee time, we're going to come back at 7 o'clock and we'll take your amendment then. Representative Haley.
A quick question. I know you want to finish up. In a previous life, I did some nonprofit consulting, and one of the organizations, Hope Coalition, is in my community, so I appreciate that list. I'm just curious how this grant... There are some current state monies here. If you can describe where those come from, and then how does this intersect with OJP funding that these organizations get? I support your effort. I'm just trying to make sure we're not kind of colliding with other sources.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The idea is that this would not be supplanting any of the dollars that come to some of these organizations through the Office of Justice program. So OJP funding and the criminal justice side of things, that's funded based on crime victims. And so this is getting at something different. So this prevention programs that could be expanded or new programs that we could look into doing, the idea is not that it's all the same money going to the same kind of thing. Our criminal justice system is reactive, and this is a proactive thing that we're trying to do, so it'd be different programs.
Okay. Thank you. Clarification, Madam Chair?
Representative Haley.
So just clarifying, that makes sense to me, so thanks. So we don't have any current state money that goes into prevention. Is that a fair statement?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd have to ask exactly, maybe she has an answer here, but, these are nonprofits. They get funding from other places, but this would be targeted at these specific things.
Ms. Kramer?
Katie Slive from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. I just want to, Madam Chair and members, I just want to speak to the prevention question. There is no current domestic violence prevention funds at the state level in Minnesota. There are funds which are listed in the Q&A packet. There's a small fund in the Department of Health which is actually federally funded, and then a small amount of around $300,000 allocated to OJP, to MNCASA for sexual violence prevention funds. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Haley.
Thank you.
Okay, so members, we do have an amendment from Representative Franson. I haven't seen the amendment. We will be in this room at the call of the chair, so watch your emails. The room is reserved for the policy committee in case it's needed for them. If their committee ends and doesn't need that time, then we can come back earlier. If not, you know, it could be later into the evening, but it would be in this room, so we're going to recess to the call of the chair. Representative Franson, if you can distribute your amendment to us, or Ms. Clark, this can get it out to us, and we can take it up quickly when we come back. So, Representative Olson, before we break.
Yes, Madam Chair. I just was referring to the rules, and rule number 7 says substantial amendment should be filed in advance if possible, and I know you have discretion as a chair, but was this an amendment? I mean, we haven't seen it yet. I understand we took a verbal or an oral amendment today. That seems within the realm of what you've put forward in number 7. But as the discretion of the chair, before we recess and decide to come back at 7, could you have some look to see if this meets the threshold for substantial?
Well, Representative Olson, that's your discretion. Just a suggestion. I do not have a 24-hour rule in this committee, I leave it to members' good faith, whether they're putting forward amendments because they really want to work on a bill. I do want to say, again, that the bill is being laid over, so there will be another opportunity, and you can always talk to the chair offline about your concern and see if she will incorporate that. I don't know what Representative Franson's concern is or whether she has done that. Representative Franson, do you want to speak to that before we adjourn?
I think Elizabeth can quickly handle the amendment.
Well, we are way past our time here, so.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're trying to wrap up, but I did want to thank our testifiers. This is a difficult topic, and there is a price that's paid emotionally for folks when they come in and share these things with us, and so I wanted to acknowledge that and thank our testifiers, and then just let folks know I have no knowledge of this amendment, and neither do the folks who've been working on this, and, you know, in thinking of transparency, you know, nobody knows what's going on right now.
Right. That is true, Representative Becker-Finn. And I would hope that when an author knows they're going to come in with an amendment, that they would speak to the author of the bill just in the interest of transparency and so on, and perhaps even speak to the chair. But that said, we don't have a 24-hour rule in the committee. We will maintain the lack of a 24-hour rule as long as members are in good faith about actually working on bills, which hopefully will include talking to people if they know in advance. Sometimes you don't know. So with that, members, we stand in recess. Committee will please come back to order. Thank you, members, for coming back. And, I'm hoping that we can move through our remaining business pretty quickly, because I know the weather isn't so great and a lot of people probably want to get on the road. So Representative Franson has offered the A1 amendment. I think we have it before us. Does anyone not have the amendment? And Representative Franson, to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So my amendment, Elizabeth, do you want to just go over it?
Ms. Clarkquist?
Sure. Representative Franson, Madam Chair and members, so this amendment does two things. It expands the scope of the existing grant program to include the idea of sexual violence, and it also amends the definition of domestic violence and sexual assault to be domestic violence, sexual violence, and sexual assault includes the listed items on page 2, lines 15 to 20, and it adds female genital mutilation to that list.
OK, Okay, so Representative Franson, if you could explain the amendment, please, or why you're moving this amendment.
So thank you. So female genital mutilation is sexual violence. It's sexual assault, as it destroys the genital anatomy and causes permanent disfigurement and lifelong health and sexual complications. Around the world, more than 200 million have been affected by this, according to the World Health Organization. And with the two girls that were taken from Minnesota to Michigan to have this barbaric procedure performed, I feel that this is a good start into making sure that not one more little girl is harmed. And female genital mutilation is on par with sexual abuse, certainly qualifies as sexual violence. It's a human rights issue, gender violence, and women's health issue.
So, Representative Franson, could you explain, besides that piece, and we understand that the amendment adds female genital mutilation to the list here under Subdivision 3 as one of the things that would be defined as domestic violence and sexual assault, but why, if you could explain, why are you adding the term sexual violence throughout the bill?
Sexual violence goes right on with the, let's see here if I can find the chapter of law there, fits right in with the 609.342 and being a criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. So it would be rape with a dangerous weapon, statutory rape, or rape with an assault are examples of those crimes. And I think by using object to harm a woman in such a way would be considered sexual assault.
So
it also in the bill that I have, it's House File, can't think of the House File right now, but anyway, the female genital mutilation bill that I had brought forward to the House floor in 2017 that I reintroduced this year classifies female genital mutilation as sexual assault as well.
So, Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I acknowledge, you know, the attention you're trying to bring to this issue. I think because, you know, the way that this law would function, if in the definition, and as you just said, Representative Franson, you said, genital mutilation is sexual assault. So, if we're already including sexual assault in the definition, I think we can still include what you want to include by just having lines 1.6 through 1.9 from the amendment. I just think it kind of it just adds additional words and complicates things in a way that I don't think is necessary by adding the word sexual violence. I think domestic violence and sexual assault, already includes sexual violence, and by we're defining what it means within the bill, and so I think that should cover it without adding the word sexual violence throughout.
Okay, but at the
Representative Franson.
Thank you. In the end goal, though, we are including female genital mutilation in this, correct?
Madam Chair.
Representative Becker Finn.
Yeah, my suggestion, I would accept your suggestion, but instead of the entire A1 amendment, I would say that we would just move the lines 1.6 through 1.9, so you're still adding that number 7 within the definition, but then not changing the entire title of the bill and making it really a long title when I think sexual violence, the intent is that sexual violence would be included within that definition.
Okay.
So, Representative Becker Finn, what you're suggesting then is to strike lines 1.2 to 1.5 of the amendment and 1.10 to 1.11?
Correct, Madam Chair.
And so that would leave lines 1.6 to 1.9 if we were to do that. And Representative Franson, would you incorporate that into your amendment?
Yes.
Okay, so Representative Franson incorporates that change into her amendment, striking lines 1.2 to 1.5 and striking lines 1.10 to 1.11. And Ms. Clarkvist, does that work still for the amendment? And she says it does. Okay. So Representative Franson is moving the A1 amendment with that change incorporated. All those in favor, please say aye. Oh, I'm sorry. You know what, members? I didn't open it up for other discussion. Sorry. Is there any other discussion? Okay, seeing none. All right. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment as amended or as with the changes incorporated, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the amendment as amended is passed. So is there any other discussion to the bill? Is there anyone else, and I'm sorry we didn't do this earlier, but is there anyone else in the room, any members of the public who want to testify for or against the bill? Okay. Is there any other discussion to the bill? All right. Seeing none, so House File 479 as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion in the division bill. And Representative Becker-Finn?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to bring folks back to the testimony that we heard today. You know, it was a little distracting at the end of the hearing with how things happened today, but at the end of the day, I do want to acknowledge the stories that were shared with us and how important it is that those folks are willing to come forward and share some really traumatic experiences that they went through. And there is a toll on folks when they're willing to come out in the public and share those things with us. And so I just want to bring us back to keeping that as really the focus of today's hearing.
Yes, thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. And we certainly appreciated hearing from the testifiers. And I would just remind members, you know, we don't have a 24-hour rule in this committee. It really is my intention that we be able to work on bills and that everybody's ideas be brought forward. But in order to make this a smooth process, if you have a bill, an amendment you'd like to make, please try to talk to the bill author or bring it to me as the chair. And if you're not able to get it drafted, you know, if it's, I understand this one was kind of drafted at the last second, there might not have been time, but let us know what's coming, you know, just so that we can try to pace ourselves and try to, you know, on bills where members really want to give input, and I appreciate that members do want to give input often, you know, just to try to, it's a learning experience, I understand, because we haven't done this procedure in a number of years, but you know, it would be good if we could kind of all work together as a group and have a little bit more respectful process, I would say, so that we have time and can pace ourselves and don't end up coming back in the evening like this. So with that, members, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion, and thank you very much for coming back, and we are adjourned.